Joining us today, we have David Ray Griffin, who is a professor emeritus of philosophy and religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology in California for the last 30 years. David Ray Griffin has today, through his books and lectures, become better known as one of the leading voices of the 9/11 truth movement. Through his investigation and analysis of the fall of the Twin Towers and the collapse of the World Trade Center 7, the attack on a Pentagon, and a final 9/11 commission report, Griffin continues to raise provocative questions about the inconsistencies and contradictions of the official version of the events of September 11th. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Please go right ahead, and if you would be so kind as to introduce us to what you'll be covering in your upcoming lecture here in Cambridge.
The topic is whether the war in Afghanistan is justified. I ask whether it is legally justified and point out that it is not, so that it is an illegal war, both under international and U.S. law. And then I devote the majority of the lecture to the question whether it has been morally justified by the 9/11 attacks. And I present the three main points that have been used by both the Bush administration and now the Obama administration to claim that the war is justified, and I argue that all three points are false.
And it seems fairly obvious to people who have devoted a bit of time to trying to suss out the actual story here that a diversion is necessary. And perhaps you could speak to us for a bit as to why that is.
You're talking about deception with regard to the official account of 9/11?
Yes, absolutely, because as the time has gone by and research has been done by yourself and others, the glaring inconsistencies between the evidence available and the official cover story continues to erode the credibility of the government, so we have to have, in essence, a target for the public to focus on.
Yes. Well, with regard to the erosion of the credibility of the story, it has really been remarkable over the past couple years. And, you know, in these operations, most people get their mind made up rather early on, and then when new evidence comes out that shows the official story is just flat out false, they don't pay attention because, well, I made up my mind about that. And you try to explain evidence and they just roll their eyes or they get angry, actually. And because they don't want to deal, you know, they made up their mind and they've decided the 9/11 truth movement is a bunch of kooks. And I give a bunch of examples and show that when people say things like that, it is the official story. It is absolutely crazy. You can't believe the official story if you know what it is. And so all we need to do is tell people what the official story is, and they start laughing. It is so absurd. And then when we get to my most recent book, which is about World Trade Center 7, we're talking about miracles, where the official theory affirms a miracle, meaning a violation of basic laws of nature, laws of physics. And as I point out, they even almost come out and admit it in their final report. They were forced into it by a high school physics teacher who just pointed out very elementary physics showed that their collapse theory, how Building 7 came down, is simply physically impossible. And in the final report, they virtually admitted that. They were saying in their preliminary report, they keep saying, and this is consistent with physical principles. And this is consistent with physical principles, meaning basic laws of physics. In the final report, they deleted all those instances. So you've got almost an explicit admission by NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which put out the official report, that their report contradicts the laws of physics, but it was the best they could do because they could not admit, being a government agency, and they did this work while they were an agency of the Bush-Cheney administration, they could not say the building was brought down by explosives. And yet, according to very basic laws of physics, that's the only way it could have been brought down. And we have, almost 1,200 licensed architects and engineers who have signed a document stating that there needs to be a new investigation. We've got physicists and chemists and firefighters and intelligence officers and military officers and pilots and all saying the official story is simply false. And some publications, some propagandists like to say, oh, there are thousands of scientists who support the official story. We say, name them. Give us the names of anybody who is not a government employee who has written anything in support of the official theory, and you can't find more than three or four of them, and it's doubtful that they are really independent of government funding.
Well, it's very interesting when we take a look below the surface at NIST and the glaring gaps in their investigation, the utter unwillingness to even test for explosive residue by simply making the claims that they don't believe there was any. And in particular, are you familiar with some of the publications by Kevin Ryan?
Oh, of course.
Yes. He has a fabulous four-part write-up on basically the demolition access to the towers. And this was something that had come up in questions years back when I was arguing this with other people that refused to accept anything but what the government said. But as it turns out, you have a lot of personnel in NIST who are intimately familiar with the nanotechnology involved with the thermite that was conceivably used for this. I wonder if you could illuminate us a little bit further with some of the odd configurations in NIST regarding the, you know, the experience of the personnel with high explosives and advanced materials.
Yes, I dealt with this, and using Kevin Ryan's work in the mysterious collapse of the World Trade Center, of World Trade Center 7. And, the science of the buildings is really settled now, and that's the final point I make, particularly with regard to World Trade Center 7. A lot of people still think, those planes hit those towers and created such big fires and weakened the buildings, and so I can understand how they came down. Well, that's just not true. I mean, it's not physically possible, but people think they have an intuitive understanding of that. But when they get over to Building 7, they start drawing a blank, because this building was not hit by a plane. Therefore, it had no jet fuel in it to get big fires started. You had a few little fires on a few floors, NIST even admits. There were significant fires on only six floors of this 47-story building. And yet it comes down suddenly at virtually free fall acceleration, and for over 2 seconds in absolute free fall. That's what is, the miracle that NIST affirms. They want to say, well, no, the explosives were not used to remove all the steel support columns and all that concrete, but nevertheless, the building came down in free fall. Well, any engineer, any scientist knows that's impossible, and yet that's what they affirm. So I say the science is settled, and so then the question is, okay, who put the explosives in the building? What were the explosives was one question, and who could have gotten in there? Now, interestingly, there is a prominent Cambridge intellectual who has said in public that, if their buildings were brought down by explosives, then that just shows you how clever Al-Qaeda is. They got in the building and put in the explosives. But nobody on NIST or any in the government, nobody has offered that as a possible explanation because they know it's just impossible that Al-Qaeda operatives could have gotten in those buildings for all the hours it would have taken to plant explosives. But on the other hand, we know that it is possible for insiders to get in there, and that becomes even more plausible when you realize that one of the principals for the company, Securecom, that handles security for the World Trade Center was a man named Marvin Bush, one of the president's brothers, and that a man named Wirt Walker III, one of their cousins, I guess he's kind of a remote cousin, but a cousin, was in charge of, he was the CEO. So when people start learning these kinds of facts, then they say, oh, well, you know, maybe we've been sold a bill of goods here.
Yeah, it's also interesting to note that one of the tenants of the floors that were impacted in the towers themselves happened to have connection to this group as well. And you had mentioned the fireproofing, but these buildings were erected in the 70s and used asbestos in parts of the mechanical systems, and there was an ongoing effort to upgrade and replace items such as the fireproofing. It turns out that when dealing with nanomaterials, by addition of simple compounds such as silica, which is by its nature very, very small, you get what's called a sol gel, which in essence makes thermite into a paintable paste that can be sprayed or dipped or spun or any number of different methods of application that would be applied to steel members prior to the spraying on of conventional fireproofing. And it has also been reported to self-propagate so that once you get an ignition, the material is consumed.
Yes, I did. I'm not an expert on that sort of thing, but I did report that Kevin Ryan found in the literature that's what was said. Now, whether one can spray on enough, I don't know. And you know what the quantities of the nanothermite. I know it's an extremely powerful, high explosive. But the details there, we really can't speak with certainty. We can speak with certainty about some basic ideas that the official theory is false, that there was nanothermite, unreacted nanothermite, found in the World Trade Center dust. They had five different independently gathered samples. They all had the same chemical signature. And so we can say that. Now, if we could get somehow or another, get a real investigation, we could find out easily enough what they used and how much and all of that. So I just stick to the basic point that the official story is false, and it's false no matter where you start. You start with the hijackers, you start with the Pentagon attack, you start with the crash of Flight 93, you start with the cell phone calls from the planes. I mean, everybody knows that the people on the planes made cell phone calls. Well, we, 9/11 Truth Movement, started arguing in 2003 and 2004 that those were impossible. And then the defenders say, oh, that's ridiculous. You guys don't know what you're talking about. And Popular Mechanics was saying, oh, 40,000 feet, 50,000 feet. You can make high-altitude cell phone calls from airliners. At the same time they were doing that, the FBI was undercutting them. They were presenting a report to the Moussaoui trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker. And in that report, they took back all those claims about high-altitude cell phone calls and said that the only calls made from cell phones were when the Flight 93 was just about ready to crash, so it was down at a low altitude. But all those calls that people had been absolutely certain they were called on a cell phone, one woman saw the caller ID of her husband. That was Dina Burnett and her husband Tom Burnett. So she knew he'd used a cell phone, and yet now the FBI says, no, he used a feedback phone. So they've admitted these high-altitude cell phone calls were impossible, And then the most famous of all the calls from Barbara Olson to, you know, the former CNN commentator and married to Ted Olson, the Solicitor General for the Department of Justice. He said he got two calls from Barbara that morning. One was about a minute and the other was 2, 3, or 4 minutes. And she told him about hijackers taking over the planes with knives and box cutters. And now the FBI says, well, that never happened. I mean, that's just astounding. And yet we can't get the press to report it because, well, we're conspiracy theorists. And everybody knows conspiracy theorists are nutty, and anything they say must be false.
Well, and it's also been my observation that when a person presents a clear, cogent question or argument relating this, it seems to be impossible for folks to actually hear and respond to the question raised. For example, Diane Rehm is a nationally syndicated show on National Public Radio. It's a fairly good show. However, one time when a caller raised the question about the flaws in a government story and the, you know, fact that things just don't add up, and then went in to discuss the efforts of the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth and other serious, factual, research-based efforts underway to get to the root of what actually happened, the only response that the host and her guests were ever able to generate was labeling the caller and those who thought like him as wild-eyed, crazy conspiracists without even addressing the point that he was referring to serious scholarly work being done.
Yeah, this is called ad hominem argument. You ignore the point and you try to discredit it by saying something negative about the person, the messenger. And that's logic 101. Ad hominem arguments are invalid. You must treat the substance of the criticism,
but
and not say it can't be true and we don't need to pay attention to it because this is a disreputable person who's making the criticism.
Right, but since there is such thin gruel provided by the government to actually justify the events of that day and the aftermath, there isn't much to counter-argue with, so that it seems that about all they've got is ad hominem and the government said it was this way. And that brings us back around to where we
started. Let me go back to that point on it, because the Huffington Post refuses, as a matter of principle, it has a written policy. We do not deal with conspiracy theories on this post. Well, I pointed out, and one very well-known person in communication, Mark Crispin Miller, pointed it out then, reinforced it, that therefore the Huffington Post can never quote President Obama when he refers to the attacks on the United States by Al-Qaeda, because that is a conspiracy theory. That's the original conspiracy. A conspiracy is simply when two or more people agree in secret to do something illegal or immoral or monstrous. And so that was the original 9/11 conspiracy theory. Now, I've got a new book coming out that's a response to a paper written by Cass Sunstein, who was a lawyer, law professor at the University of Chicago, and then Harvard University Law School. And he was appointed by Obama to head up one of his offices, OIRA, Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. And in his article, which he co-authored with another Harvard professor, they come right out and admit, of course, the 9/11, the Al-Qaeda theory, that's a conspiracy theory. He says, well, it's a true conspiracy theory. So you've got two alternative conspiracy theories. And if the Huffington Post says we don't deal with conspiracy theories, they can't quote anybody who appeals to the Al-Qaeda theory. And that's the, you know, kind of absurd position people get themselves into with this one-sided use of the term conspiracy theory.
And it serves to effectively just stop the conversation in its tracks. There are a number of prominent websites that purport to be serious about the issues that simply will not bring this up because there are always people who join into the conversation who do not have the goal of getting to the bottom of what occurred, but rather to stifle discussion. And this is pervasive, and I can understand how the site administrators don't want the food fight. But like I say, this brings us back around to the great diversion, which is the war in Afghanistan. And we continue to cost and lose lives there. It takes up a lot of ink and a lot of headlines. And I still don't know what the tie between the Taliban and 9/11 is. Is there any? I don't think so.
Well, as I point out, the government's case is based on 3 points. One is that we were attacked by Al-Qaeda on 9/11. Second point is they were under the inspiration of Osama bin Laden, who was in Afghanistan at the time, and he's the one who authorized the attacks. And then third, we had to invade Afghanistan because the Taliban refused to turn bin Laden over to American authorities. And so in my lecture, I point out that all three of those claims are simply false. They're historically false. And so the excuse for being in Afghanistan and now increasingly in Pakistan is completely bogus. It's based on a lie. It's besides being technically illegal under international and U.S. law. And so here we are talking about trying to save some money, and the president now says everything's on the table with regard to the budget, and that seems to mean Social Security and Medicare. So here we are talking about willing to rob these entitlements that people have paid into in order to not have one thing on the table. It doesn't sound like the military budget's on the table. So that's sacred, and we can keep upping the amount. So we're spending over half of our budget on military matters, and can't stop to ask, well, is this basis for this war? You know, Obama said the war in Iraq was a war of choice. It was a bad choice, one we shouldn't make. Well, I make the case here that the war in Afghanistan is equally a war of choice. It was a war of choice at the beginning. It was a war of choice now. And an equally bad choice based on equally illegitimate reasons.
And yet again, we have a government that now has a vested interest in maintaining the lie, because to do otherwise is to lose face.
Yeah, and also lose an enormous amount of money that's going into the coffers of people who support campaigns. And that's the other huge problem we've got, is the way we finance elections. And so that the highest bidder wins, and then the politicians do the bidding of these highest bidders because they want to get funded next time. And the common people, and therefore the common good, gets hardly even the short end of the stick. We don't get any of the stick at all anymore, increasingly. So that's what I'm trying to do in this lecture, is just expose people to some very elementary facts that show that the official account of 9/11 is not only possibly false or probably false, but definitely, absolutely false. I was a professor of philosophy. One of my subjects was epistemology. And that's the question of what do we know and how do we know it. And when you study that, you learn, you know, there aren't really many things I can say I know for sure, because knowledge means justified true belief. You can't know something unless it's true. You can't know something unless the grounds on which you believe that idea are adequate grounds. So there aren't a whole lot of things that we can say we know. But I will say I know the official story is false. And that's very discouraging then to know something like that. And we can't get our mainstream media to even report the evidence that we appeal to, even though we can show that the official theory not only is riddled with self-contradictions, not only is riddled with absurdities, but is simply counter to basic laws of physics. We've just got a major social science journal that has come out and said, you know, what these 9/11 truth scientists like Stephen Jones have done, and then in his case lost his tenured position for, is simply pointing out that the laws of physics about which there is no dissent whatsoever, those laws rule out the official theory. And you would think that you would thank somebody for pointing out such a thing instead of firing them.
Well, however, it does undermine authority if you point out that authority has been lying. We have a situation now where there's been a great deal of co-joining between industry, commerce, and government. We have a media, which is obviously a commercial enterprise, and the powers that be are not going to allow out information that damages their credibility, that risks their position. Because, I mean, let's face it, if it was broadly reported side by side, here's what the government says, here is what physics tells us is possible in this set of conditions. If the government has shown up and the media has shown up to be complicit in covering up what amounts to a coup, in essence, then all of these politicians' jobs are at risk. All of the faith that has been put in the government is in question. And
also that of these news organizations that have supported this ridiculous conspiracy theory put out by the Bush administration. There's a major newspaper in Montreal where we're going to speak tomorrow night, Richard Gage and I. And they put out a terribly, from a journalistic standpoint, terribly written hit piece. And the author of it, a woman, says, well, our theories have been scientifically refuted many times. That's simply not false. They cannot point to one scientific refutation of what we have said about the World Trade Center. We can point to thousands of people who say that the official theory has been scientifically refuted. And they go to such extremes that here, you know, just to give a personal example, because it's one that I know, I have written 36 books, mainly in philosophy of religion, philosophy of science, and theology, and now I've written 9 about 9/11. And they quote a fellow in there as saying that I am intellectually dishonest. Well, a new newspaper report from Montreal came out today, and they point out this fellow is a doctoral student. So to criticize a professor who's professor emeritus and has written 36 books and something like 200 articles, they quote a guy who doesn't even have his PhD yet and use him as an authority. I don't know what journalism school this person went to think that is acceptable journalism.
Well, I'd be willing to bet that this man has a very bright career awaiting him for being willing to compromise truth to power in such a fashion.
Well, gee, you're just much more cynical than I am. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to have to go now.
Well, we thank you so much for joining us, David Ray Griffin. We'll be in town here at Cambridge on May 8th. And you can find information linking to that from our website, Truth and Justice Radio. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.